Welcome, listeners, to our Shooter's Corner Thanksgiving special. We're here with myself, Chuck Indereed, and we also have Boise Bell, Miss Cindy with us. Matt, as always, is our lovely hang around.
I'm here.
And today we have a special guest with us today, Cindy's friend, Ann.
We have Ann May.
Yep, Ann May.
Hi, everybody.
It's going to be awesome. Okay, remember, you can always listen live to the show at KFARradio.com. Just click on that big orange ball that says listen live. And there's also apps out there as well at the Apple and the Android place. Download them, and you can listen live to the show at any location in the world, especially if you have Starlink or something like that and you're out in the middle of moose camp. Yeah, perfect. Good. Let's start the show. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. As I said earlier, this is our Thanksgiving special. So if you're listening to us while you're wandering around your kitchen, nibbling on black olives and sticking them on your fingers and getting the turkey ready and the family's about ready to come over for, you know, I don't know, Turkey Day fight night. Nonetheless, just bear with us here. Here's my editorial for our Thanksgiving special. While you're prepping or preparing, like, what the heck is wrong with me?
You need prepping. Smart water.
Yeah,
morning.
Right? Okay. While you're prepping the bird and the fixings, let's pause and remember what this holiday is really about and why the right to keep and bear arms is woven right into its story. Started back in September of 1620, 102 souls, men, women, and children crowded aboard a leaky 180-ton merchant ship called the Mayflower in Plymouth, England. Roughly half were the religious separatists we call pilgrims. The other half were strangers looking for economic opportunity. They already fled to Holland in 1608 to escape King James's the first, persecution, fines, imprisonment, and worse for daring to worship outside the Church of England. In Holland, they found religious tolerance, but they also faced cultural erosion, hard labor, and a looming war with Spain. So they struck a deal with investors, secured a patent from a Virginia company, and set sail for the New World, seeking a place where they could live under their own conscience and govern themselves. They came heavily armed because they knew freedom doesn't come free and survival certainly doesn't. Historical records show the Mayflower carried at least 48 muskets, 13 fowling pieces, which are early versions of shotguns, perfect for taking turkeys and waterfowl, hundreds of pounds of gunpowder, tons of lead shot, bullet molds, swords, bandoliers, and at least four small cannon called murderers and sakers mounted on deck. Every able-bodied man was expected to stand watch and fight. William Bradford, who would become governor of Plymouth Colony, later wrote that they brought arms and munitions in abundance because they expected hostility from natives, from the wilderness, and possibly from European rivals. They needed every bit of it. The first winter was brutal. Half the colony died of cold, hunger, and disease. But in March 1621, when Somerset and later Squanto walked into camp, the pilgrims greeted them with armed sentries standing post. Their firearms helped secure the peace treaty with the Massasoit that kept them safe and alive long enough to plant crops and eventually celebrate that first Thanksgiving in the fall of 1621. 3 days of feasting, games, and marksmanship demonstrations alongside the Wamapoag. That brings us to the first Thanksgiving tradition that a lot of people or folks have forgotten, the turkey shoot. I actually remember these.
Remember, like, Dad used to go out all the time and...
Not shoot turkeys, but I remember them being organized shoots like at the local church and stuff like that. Like, well, we were in Idaho then, so... From the earliest colonial days straight through the 19th and into the 20th century, Thanksgiving and Christmas weren't complete without a friendly shooting match. Farmers and town folks would gather on the village green or behind the church. A live turkey, or later a paper target, was staked out at 100 to 150 yards. Shooters paid a small fee, took their best shot with rifle or smoothbore, and the winner took home the bird for dinner. It was community, competition, and training all rolled into one. Families passed down heirloom rifles the same way they passed down grandma's pie recipe. Marksmanship was celebrated, not demonized. That tradition reminds us firearms were not just tools for war. They were tools for feeding families, for fellowship, and for preserving the independence our forefathers crossed an ocean to claim. Fast forward 450 years. We sit down at tables groaning under more food than the pilgrims saw in a lifetime. We live in a country built on the radical idea that rights come from God, not government. Mm-hmm. That a free people have not only the right but the duty to keep and bear arms, so tyranny never takes root here like it did in England. They fled. Yet today that inheritance is under constant attack. We're told the guns the guns that helped the Pilgrims survive and that fed generations of Americans at Thanksgiving were suddenly weapons of war that civilians shouldn't have. We're told to trade liberty for the illusion of safety, just like subjects of the crown were told centuries ago. This Thanksgiving, let's give real thanks. Thanks for the separatists who refused to bow to a king's dictates on faith and freedom. Thanks to the matchlocks and the fowling pieces that stood watch over a starving colony. Thanks to the millions of Americans since who have kept those old traditions alive, hunting, competing, and training so the flame never goes out. And then let's make a pledge around the table. We'll train harder, vote smarter, teach the next generation why the Second Amendment matters, and never, ever apologize for exercising the rights the Mayflower passengers risked everything to secure. From all of us at Shooter's Corner, go hug your family, say grace for this incredible country, oil up your rifle, and maybe even set up a turkey shoot in the backyard this weekend. Because an armed and grateful people is the best way to honor the real story of Thanksgiving. God bless you, God bless the Second Amendment, and God bless America. That's my editorial for Thanksgiving.
Very nice. Very nice.
What say you, Matt?
I think that was lovely and moving, and I like history. So hearing more about it and hearing things that I didn't know possibly happened, just because I'm uninformed, is really cool. So thank you for that, Chuck.
All right. Well, thank you. My love language is encouragement. I don't know why I was getting all like choked up. I haven't even eaten turkey yet.
Well, did you know the pilgrims did pray on
the
first?
The who did? The what?
Pilgrims did. You stop, Chuck. The pilgrims did pray at the first Thanksgiving.
Okay. Well, we can talk about that a little bit later on when we start getting into the dynamics of the whole Thanksgiving thing. But yeah, that's awesome. Okay.
We'll talk about that then.
Yeah. So the real Thanksgiving Day special is the guns that saved Plymouth, the real story of the first Thanksgiving. So let's talk about that a little bit. I know that, you know, a lot of us are sitting around right now talking about turkey or basting our turkeys and watching football. Who's even playing on Thanksgiving?
Sweet potato
normally the
pie.
Cowboys, but nobody really watches them anymore, I don't think. Anyways, So we're going to go back to 1621 when a handful of English settlers and their firearms turned starvation into survival and a harvest celebration into a legend we call Thanksgiving. Without the matchlock musket, the fowling piece, and the iron-willed men who carried them, there is no Plymouth colony, and quite possibly no America as we know it. All right, so grab a cup of coffee, throw another log on the fire, and let's talk about guns, guts, and gratitude. We know in September of 1620, 102 passengers, half of them were religious separatists we call pilgrims. Or what did you call them, Cindy?
Pilgrims.
Pilgrims.
Pilgrims, right?
Pilgrim.
Half the strangers were hired by the investors, okay? And they actually were called the strangers, amazingly. Cram aboard a 100-foot merchant ship called the Mayflower. They're bringing more than Bibles and hope. They're bringing the most advanced personal firearms Europe can offer in 1620. So they had the heavy matchlock muskets, 4.5 to 5 foot barrels shooting a 70 caliber lead ball that'll punch straight through the steel breastplate at 80 yards.
Wow.
They had lighter fowling pieces that were smoothbore scatter guns for duck, geese, and yes, wild turkey. They had a few high-end snap haunts or wheel lock pieces owned by the leaders, like Captain Miles Standish. He carried a snap haunts that works in the rain when matchlocks fail. If you don't know what a snap haunts or a wheel lock were, what it was a device where if they pulled the trigger, it would spin and then it would generate a spark. I think like when I was a kid, I had like an old toy that would do that. If you've ever like had
those
like a spark
ones.
Gun and you'd pull it and then it would shoot sparks out the front. That kind of think of that mechanism as being the same as a snap haunts. And
that's
that would
cool.
be what ignites the powder. Yeah. Hence the reason why it would work in the rain, right? Whereas a matchlock, which we'll talk about later on, you had to light a nitrous, like infused cotton wick, and then like keep that lit, right? Which didn't work well in the rain, but nonetheless. And then at last but not least, they had at least 10 cannon minions, Sakers, that ended up guarding the Hilltop Fort, Meeting House, and Plymouth. And with that, I think we need to go into our first break. Awesome. So stay tuned. When we come back, we're going to continue on our conversation about the surviving gun from the Mayflower. And we're going to talk about that first winter and how the Pilgrims actually survived by developing alliances with the locals. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with our special edition Thanksgiving Shooter's Corner. Right back. Welcome back, listeners. You're here with Chuck, Boise Belle, Miss Cindy, and Matt, and her friend, Anne, May, with our special edition of Shooter's Corner for our Thanksgiving special. Yeah, yeah.
They need we just got done talking. After me.
What? Yeah, the Mayflower.
Mayflower after me. The Mayflower was named after me.
They may have. Well, there you go. There's the key. All right. So, nonetheless, we just got done talking about some of the firearms that the Pilgrims brought over with them on the Mayflower, including some, at the time, some pretty high-end snap hanses and wheel locks and stuff like that that the captain had brought. But nonetheless, so the one surviving gun that we know about that crossed on the Mayflower was John Alden's beautiful wheel lock carbine, which was a 50 caliber. It was traced straight to the cooper who hired on as a ship's carpenter and ended up on one of the signers of the compact, the Mayflower compact. You can see it today at the NRA National Firearms Museum in Fairfax. So things actually exist. I think that's pretty cool. These were not hunting toys. Every adult male had trained in the English militia system. They knew the 40-plus commands of military drill, and they needed every bit of it. 40 commands.
You know, you think it's a lot, but then you start to really just pick it up after, you know, you learn the first one so many times and you go second
right,
and
so
third.
So Gunner Sabo PC.
Exactly. Fire and adjust.
Yeah. Identified fire on the way. Yeah. I don't know if I can get to 40.
Military.
No.
But then again, we got to remember what they were dealing with here, like marching in lines, shooting in lines, dying in lines.
Yeah, dying in
dying
lines.
Dying in lines.
So, all right. So the first winner. Half of them died. Guns nice. Kept the rest of them alive, right? So they dropped anchor off Cape Cod in November 11th of 1620. The first order of business was to send Miles Standish and 16 armed men ashore. They run into the Nauset warriors. The arrows fly. The muskets answer back. That's literally the first gunfire between English settlers and the Native Americans on this continent. They finally plant Plymouth in December. Winter hits like a hammer. Scurvy, pneumonia, exposure. By spring, only 53 of the original 102 are still breathing.
Wow.
William Bradford writes, they were burying their dead at night so the Indians wouldn't know how weak they'd become. That's actually a pretty interesting strategy. But the guns never stopped working. They had deer in the woods, waterfowl on every pond. Edward Winslow later wrote to friends back home, bring a musket or fowling piece, long in the barrel. Most of our shooting is from stands. Translation, set up on a game trail and wait. One well-placed 70-cal ball drops a 200-pound buck and feeds the whole common house for days. So there's actually an interesting story that I found. It's called Young Francis Billington. He was a kid who almost blew up the Mayflower by shooting his dad's fowling piece below decks. He was also out exploring one day and climbs a tree on a hill. Sees what he thinks is an ocean a couple of miles inland. Turns out to be Billington Sea. Still there today. Kid almost starts a forest fire playing with his dad's powder horn. And apparently this was a classic Billington family. They were the colony's original troublemakers. So, yeah. Kind of like the Mays were later on. Not really. I'm just joking.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
She married into the Mays.
Yeah. Okay. She knew what she was getting into. All right. So March 16th of 1621, survivors are weak, half rations, praying for help. Suddenly a nearly naked Indian walks into the village and says in broken English, welcome, Englishman. Got any beer? I don't know if he had an English accent. Should I retry that with an English accent? No. Can you try that? You try that.
Well, do we want to go off of what an actual English
no,
accent
No, you can't use your Glock. Like,
no,
what
no,
was
no.
It, Austrian
Back in the
accent.
Day, that's actually very common is Louisiana. Their accent is actually what original English sounded like.
Okay.
You can look that up.
So surprise us, Matt.
I haven't watched enough movies about Louisiana.
That sounds Cajun.
Yeah. Welcome, Englishman. Gonna be. I don't know. That's about as close as it's getting.
Yeah. That's not bad. That's Somerset, right? He was a Sagamore visiting from Maine. He'd learned English from fishermen. See, the Pilgrims weren't the first people to ever land there. I mean, there's actually historical proof that maybe the Vikings actually landed way before everybody else did, because they found Viking relics all the way up in Minnesota. Believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
He comes back the next day, okay, with Squanto, who was the last living. I don't know how to pronounce this. Patuxet, Patuxet, or whatever. Doesn't matter. But Squanto's story is wild. He was kidnapped in 1614, sold as a slave in Spain, escaped to England, lived in London, finally sailed home in 1619, only to find his entire tribe wiped out by plague.
Boo.
Yeah. That's Squanto cool. Moves in with the Pilgrims and becomes their survival instructor. That's cool. First gig. He plants corn with a fish in every hill. Interesting.
All right. Here comes Ann.
I know. Because Ann taught Cindy to use fish meal when she plants all of her plants. And they freaking do phenomenal. It's crazy. But what they were doing is obviously they have a lot of fish they can catch, right? So
liquid. What was the liquid?
It was powder.
What was
it? It was powder chum salmon that came out from the Kenai Peninsula or something like that. It came in a big old bag you can buy in the stores. Anyways, we digress. We got to stay with the story here.
I planted some sardines that I didn't like.
Oh,
under
okay.
My tomato plants. They did amazing.
It makes the tomatoes taste like fish.
Well, there we go. No, they don't.
Just kidding. Right? But anyways, he taught them how to do that, right? So the first use of natural fertilizer, right? They chased eels with their bare hands in the brooks, set weirs for fish. But he's also a diplomat who brings Chief Massasoit and 60 warriors to Plymouth on March 22nd. They negotiate a treaty that lasts 50 years, right? Better than anything that happens in the Middle East. Mutual defense, no weapons drawn inside each other's villages, trade fairly. Almost sounds like the first NATO.
Yeah.
Except for the trade part.
Maybe it is the first NATO, or we could call it the first NATO. Change history.
The Pilgrims agree to help Massasoit against his enemies, especially the other tribes in the area. And the Wampanoag see the English firearms as the perfect equalizer against tribes that outnumber them 10 to 1 after the plague. So the plague ends up decimating these huge tribes. And so now they're kind of like banding together with the Pilgrims and everything else to kind of help out with their tactical strategy, if you will, or their disadvantage. Miles Standish, 5'0", red-bearded, called Captain Shrimp behind his back. He's the muscle. Okay. Professional soldier, fought in the Low Countries. Indians respect him because he's fearless. Right? So fall comes. The corn is now 7 feet tall. Squanto's fish-tricked worked. The men go on a fowling. So four guys with long fowlers come back with enough ducks and geese to feed the colony for a week. Bradford writes, there's a great store of wild turkeys, birds that probably weighed 15 to 20 pounds dressed. Governor Bradford declares a harvest celebration. They fire off a military demonstration. What Winslow calls, we exercised our arms. Muskets, maybe even a couple of the cannon on the hill. Boom, 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 echoes for miles. 90 Wampanoag warriors, hearing what they think is the start of a war, they grab their bows, mobilize the troops, and come running, ready to honor the treaty. That's pretty cool. NATO, in effect. When they realize it's a party, Massasoit tells his men to go hunt. They come back with 5 deer, venison on spits for 3 straight days. That's the real first Thanksgiving. 53 English, only 4 married women are left alive, 90 Wampanoag warriors, 3 days of eating, athletic games, and yes, firearms demonstrations that showed the natives exactly why these newcomers were worth allying with. Folks, the Pilgrims never handed over the secret of gunpowder. They traded knives, beads, cloth, but they kept the technological edge that let the 53 half-starved settlers stand tall against thousands. So you're probably asking yourself, what are you asking yourself, Cindy?
Wow. I don't know what to think right now. I'm not. I don't know what I'm asking myself.
Why did the matchlock, and how did the matchlock work, and why was it so effective, Chuck?
I don't know.
Why I don't know, it? Cindy. Let me answer that question for you. Yes. Welcome to our Thanksgiving special. So you've got your 10 to 12 pound musket. That's a hefty piece of equipment.
That's pretty heavy. It's about a saw now. For listeners, M249 saw, roughly about 12 pounds.
Squad automatic weapon.
Yeah.
Yeah. A bandolier with 12 wooden powder charges, which mirrored the 12 original apostles. Huh. Everything was religious. So you carry 12 wooden powder charges because of the 12 apostles. Remember, they were separatists. They were pilgrims. They were religious separatists. Nice. And a pound of lead ball in a slow-burning match cord made from hemp soaked in saltpeter. So not only did they use saltpeter to keep the match alive, contrary to popular belief, like they didn't put it in their food to prevent any other things, right? So here's how you do it. You blow on your match to get the red coal glowing. You pour your main charge down the barrel, ram ball and wadding home, and then you prime the pan with fine powder, because remember there's two different types of powder. You have your pan powder, which was super fine, and then your coarser powder was your charge, right? You close the frizzen. When the command is make ready, you bring match to the serpentine, present, shoulder the piece, give fire is your other command, one of the 40 commands. Pull the trigger.
37 now.
The match drops into the pan, flash, half second later, boom. If you had pre-ignition push or you anticipated the trigger pull with a match lock,
you'd be in trouble.
Yeah, you didn't hit anything. You definitely didn't hit squat toes. You didn't hit squat.
You didn't hit squat.
Because you would go click, boom.
Right? I mean, if you anticipated and you accidentally pulled the trigger a little early, you do have enough time to maybe get a slight
make an adjustment.
Yeah, it's not like now where it's immediate. You had some leeway.
Yeah, you can get it back on. So in skilled hands, right? You had about 45 to 60 seconds per shot.
In rain.
In rain, forget it.
Were they
deaf? I'm sure they didn't use eyes or ear protection. So I'm sure with that, as that gunpowder blew up in the pan, right? I'm sure that did something to their eyesight. I mean, it definitely wasn't a night firing weapon.
Maybe the muskets were never really inaccurate. It's just everyone was blind and deaf. They couldn't really shoot the thing in the first place.
Yeah, that might be true too.
Hey, good point, man.
But in the rain with a matchlock, forget about it. And that's why those other guns, the wheel lock, the snap mounts were critical because those are the ones that created spark by that spinning wheel.
And it couldn't be raining?
It could be raining. It had zero effect on it.
Oh, good.
Because it was inside.
It was inside the little.
Yeah.
I remember Grandma had one at her house.
She had a wheel lock?
Yeah, a little toy
one. Oh, the toy ones that I talked about earlier. Yeah.
Yes, the toy.
So anyways, Miles Standish, the last captain, the little captain who cast a giant shadow, actually led some raiding parties and negotiated with hostile tribes, and in 1623 pulls off one of the guttiest preemptive strikes in American history. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about that as well. Stay tuned here, Chuck, Cindy, Matt, and her friend Ann, here at the special edition of Shooter's Corner Thanksgiving. Welcome back to Shooter's Corner. You're here with Chuck, Cindy, Miss Boise Bell, and Matt, as always. And we also have Cindy's friend, Anne, with us. When we left off, we were talking about Miles Standish, the little captain who cast a giant shadow, and how Standish was leading these raiding parties and negotiated with hostile tribes. In 1623, he actually pulled off one of the gutsiest preemptive strikes in American history, the Wessagusset Affair. The Massachusetts tribe plotting to wipe out Plymouth and another weak settlement, the Standish invites the ringleaders into a cabin for dinner, and the plot thickens. Then, at his signal, stabs the chief through the chest, and his men finish the rest. Brutal? Yes, but it scared every tribe in New England straight for a generation. Yeah, not only did NATO also have their first preemptive strike, right? If you don't know what we're talking about, go back to the beginning of the show and listen to it. All right. So later, when Mary Thomas Morton sets up a trading post, selling guns to the Indians and throwing drunken parties around a maypole, Standish marches in, arrests Morton, and ships him back to England. Morton writes a book, like they all do. Morton must have been like the original Navy SEAL.
Everybody writes a book.
They all write a book. And in his book, he called Standish Captain Shrimp. Remember before they were doing it behind their back? Now it's actually published. But the guns stayed out of hostile hands. And that's the important part. Remember, the Pilgrims did not share any technological advantages that they had because they knew that if the natives got it, it would be at their own demise. So made sense to me, I guess. Those original matchlocks are gone, rusted away, or lost to time. But we have John Alden's wheel locks, fragments of archaeological digs, and living history groups who fire them every weekend. And the lesson? Self-reliance. The Pilgrims didn't wait for government aid. They shouldered their muskets, planted corn, and defended their liberty with lead and faith. So when you sit down at that table today, look at that turkey and remember some English settler 404 years ago probably dropped that bird with a 5-foot fowling piece loaded with birdshot, and the sound of freedom's first firearms on this continent brought the Wampanoag running, not the fight, but the feast. So from all of us here at Shooter's Corner, stay armed, stay grateful, and God bless America. Now on to the important part. All right. So I've asked each person in the studio to be able to come up with what they're grateful for and maybe what their favorite dish is and what their least favorite dish is. I'll start with mine. What's my least favorite dish?
Well, tell us.
You've been married to me for 43 years, Cindy. What's my least favorite dish?
Your least favorite is the one that you said you had fish allergies and blamed it on me?
Oh, no. That was only because, like, the
that was
we
horrible.
Went to this dinner one time and the people had, what do they call it?
Fish stuffing.
No, it was like a seafood stuffing.
Yes.
It literally looked like, I don't know, your dog got sick.
And Chuck's like, well, I can't.
I told him I had shellfish allergies just so I wouldn't eat it. Like,
but Cindy can eat it. It was horrible.
It was the most disgusting thing I've ever remember seeing. Like, we were down in Georgia, and they were like, oh, yeah, we got this. Because I'm just like, I am really, honestly, I'm a stovetop stuffing kind of guy. Like, that's my stuffing.
It's pretty good.
It's actually pretty good. I think they perfected that recipe. And so, like, I don't like stuffing that's been stuffed inside of a bird, and it's all goopy and gummy and all that stuff.
Yeah, I don't either.
It doesn't do anything for me. Like, I like stuffing that I can pour gravy over, mix it with my mashed potatoes or something like that, right?
That sounded terrible. I mean, that sounds like British food, but that it just, it's always.
Because British food all sucks and bland.
It's bland, and for some reason, everything is wet. It doesn't matter if it's French fries, toast, whatever. There's beans, and everything's just wet.
Yeah. And, oh, by the way, they have a dessert called the Spotted Dick. What is that?
I don't know. They have a mud pie also. Disgusting. Yeah.
Blood pudding, which is actually real blood. All right, so anyways, back to the original story. My least favorite is green bean casserole.
It is.
Why would you take green beans and mix them in with cream of mushroom soup and then throw, like, stupid fried onions on top of it and call it a meal? Like, or I don't know. Like, I don't know. I could
see that being a dish for if you didn't have a lot of money and you were trying to make something for the family.
If you didn't have a lot of money, then don't throw the cream mushroom soup on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Just have
I'm
beans.
Just saying, you know, you
throw some salt and pepper on
your,
it. Call it a day.
Your cabinet, you pull that out. I could see that. Anything else?
Oh, no. My cream of mushroom soup's about ready to expire. Let me use it on something.
Yeah, toss it in there. Bake it. It'll be good again.
Yeah. Does that work?
I kind of have to agree with you on that.
Right?
But my least favorite would have to be dark turkey meat. I cannot handle anything with dark meat.
Really?
Yeah, that is just...
Which is boon for me.
I like
white. I didn't know
white.
That when I married her, but it's worked out well because I don't like white meat.
I like white meat.
But I love the legs and thighs.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pure, yeah.
I'm not a turkey fan anyhow.
I've always been a leg and thigh man anyways, yep. So.
Yes, sir.
Turkey.
But, all right, so that's my least favorite. My favorite would probably have to be something that I make because I'm awesome.
Chocolate pie.
I would say chocolate pie.
Yeah, you make a good chocolate pie.
Yeah, I'd have to say that. All right, so let's go around the room.
All right.
Well, what are
Matt?
You grateful for?
Matt.
What are you grateful for?
We'll get back to that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Starting with least favorite dishes, that's hard. I will say I absolutely despise, kind of how you brought it up, when people pull out stuffing and then they just put it in a bowl and say, eat it. And it's all, again, disgusting, British looking, and just yuck. My favorite dish, I do
when you
love,
say pull it out, are you talking like they pull it out from the center of the bird? They like they put it inside
yeah, they
the bird?
Pull it out and just yeah. like throw it into a plate. Like that is one, if you have just stuffing that you baked and put in a bowl, that's fine. Don't put it in the turkey. Let it sit and just collect the juice and be like, would you like to eat this? Because no, I would not. but my favorite dish, it might sound weird or some sort of a heresy here, but I like when you take turkey, dark meat, you cut it, and then you actually put it in Hawaiian rolls and make little sliders out of it. Something I grew up with. I think it was American cheese on top of it, but little sliders. It was just something that was cool growing up. Everyone was always doing turkey, ham, whatever, but having that was just something always fun for me. So I think that's my favorite dish. Little turkey
That'd be
sliders.
Leftovers for me.
Yeah, yeah.
But those Hawaiian rolls, though, if you want to take it to the next level, let's talk about like food hacks, like grill those.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You got to like put a little bit of butter on them, or actually mayonnaise mm-hmm. is actually a really good oil to use to like grilled cheese sandwiches. Don't use butter.
Yep.
Use a light coat of mayonnaise on it. It takes a grilled cheese to the next level. But nonetheless, do that, grill those. You know, I was thinking about the dressing thing too after you said that, right? Like take the drippings from the turkey and then separate it because I have a fat separator mm-hmm. you can buy off Amazon. I don't have a sponsor paid there. I should probably do that. But nonetheless, and then separate it and then just take the good juices from it and drizzle that over the dressing.
Yep.
And that takes that dressing to a whole new level too. Yep. Right.
It does. Yeah. It does.
All right, Cindy, tell us about how you like green Jello with cat food in it.
No green Jello. Favorite dishes. I love pumpkin pie. Pumpkin pie.
Remember that one year I made you a sweet potato pie?
And I love sweet potato pie. Yes, you did. He made it all by scratch. It took forever.
It did, actually.
We didn't grow the potatoes, though.
That's why it took forever.
But it was really good.
Okay. Right. And then what's your least favorite? Sin. D.
Oh, my least favorite is dark
turkey
meat.
Oh, back to the dark turkey meat thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why. That's like the juiciest part.
It's like blasphemous. Like white turkey meat, it's good the moment you cut it. After that, it dries out so quick.
If you put smothered in gravy, it does.
I can't. That's like painting a turd red. Like it looks good, but it's still like it's the same thing. It's still dry underneath
I'll leave
it, which is
the
gravy
dark
on the
meat
outside.
For you guys.
All right, yeah.
What's your favorite?
Nice, yeah. Thanks for the visual, Matt, on Thanksgiving yeah. for everybody in their kitchens.
Dick you brought up earlier.
Yeah.
Well, my mom was a fan.
Mike, please.
My mom was she's not with us anymore. She's in heaven. But she made the best stuffing, and she stuffed the bird, her and dad, and I absolutely love it. And there was nothing on the table that was my least favorite growing up. I loved everything.
Awesome. I'll tell you what. Let's do this. When we come back from our last break, we're going to talk about what we're grateful for. Because I think that's just a conversation that needs to be in and of itself, right? So stay tuned here with Chuck, Cindy, Matt, and Cindy's friend, Ann. When we come back, we're going to talk about what we're grateful for and the special edition of Shooter's Corner Thanksgiving. Welcome back, listeners. You're here with Chuck, Cindy, Matt, and her friend, Ann, here on our special edition, our special Thanksgiving edition of Shooter's Corner. And we just got done talking about the Pilgrims and how they were so resilient in their new land down there at Plymouth Corner, if you want to call it that, and how the firearms that they used were practical, not only for their defense, but also for hunting and purely their own survival as well. And I think it's incredibly important that we remember that. I think it's important that we understand that the Second Amendment was derived by our forefathers for the simple purpose of our own defense and not just for providing food for our families and such. Like, so as I alluded to earlier, if you're sitting there looking at that turkey on the table today and you like want to, you know, recall maybe a pilgrim that may have done the same thing, you know, 400 plus years ago, then understand that you also probably, depending on where you live in this country, have that same ability to go out and harvest your own wild turkey for your own Thanksgiving as well. And that's because we in America have that Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. And that is probably, if not one thing that I'm grateful for, that is probably the primary thing that I'm grateful for, is the country that I live in. Having served 24 years in the U.S. Army Infantry, I understand and have been in other countries where they do not have that privilege. They don't have rights like we have here. The right to complain about your government, the right to have no king's parade, the right to speak out against the government and write down stuff and burn your flag and everything else. Like, you try that in another country that I've been in before, you're going to be in the city square with your head chopped off. I think it's important that we should be grateful for the land that we live in, period. Here's something else I'm grateful for. I'm grateful for my helper. And it was interesting because yesterday I was watching a video about how God made Adam. And not to get all biblical on you, but God never meant for man to walk alone. He actually provided us with a spouse and a family and a friends and stuff. And I think that if you're married, you understand that your wife is God's personal provision for you. A strong ally who actually complements you, your strengths, your weaknesses, and challenges you in both your strengths and weaknesses, and stands beside you through your life joys and trials. She's your not subordinate in value. She's equal in dignity and uniquely fitting to be your partner. So, Cindy, I'm grateful.
I'm grateful for you, too.
All right, you got your choice in part later. You don't have to, like, segue off of mine like an old first sergeant.
Yeah, it's a caveat. Coming,
yeah, yeah.
It's
like
a caveat
off. Let me piggyback off the commander.
Yeah.
Sure.
Right?
All right, so, son, go ahead.
I thought we were going this way.
No, we're not done yet. I'm not done. It says Chuck Indereed in Shooter Corner.
It's my show.
But no, I'm grateful for my family, you know? Not only grateful for where we live and stuff. I'm grateful for my work. I'm grateful for what I've done, what we've accomplished. And I say we have accomplished, because without you, I probably would have been in jail right after I got out of high school in Idaho, to be quite honest with you. I was kind of a rug rat. So you're the yin to my yang, if you will. So I appreciate that. So. Yeah. All right, Mr. Matt. And no, you can't caveat off of what I just said.
To uncaveat off of what Chuck just said. No, I will start with my family. I'm very grateful for my family, specifically my wife and my children. They keep me level-headed, and they keep me very appreciative of what others may not have. The other thing I'm grateful for is the fact that all of us here were born in the U.S., and contrary to popular belief, being born in the U.S., your life is on easy mode. Like Chuck said, I've also been to other countries as well, that you do anything wrong, you look at someone the wrong way, you could be shot. There's just a lot of really evil in the world. So no matter how bad your life gets, if you're in the U.S., someone has it way worse. So you should take it with a grain of salt. The other thing I'm grateful for is the fact that I'm even alive. I've had a lot of really bad run-ins, a lot of things that were out of my control, and a lot of things that I had control over. But very lucky to still be standing here, all things considered. And then I guess the last thing I'm grateful for is Amazon Prime. No, I'm really grateful for the fact that, one, that my wife was able to get us orders to come up here, but two, for actually you, Chuck, and you, Sydney, the opportunity to work for something that means more than anything for myself, and it's bigger than just, you know, one's acts. You're helping the community. We're able to help teach people, get people prepared, do so much stuff, and it's all for good. And this is just a really fun job. It's really cool to be with you guys and make lifelong friends, and just it's awesome. So I'm very thankful for you guys.
Thank you, Matt. I'm just lost for words. I love you, Chuck. And I'm just so thankful. The one thing, you know, we learned in life, and as time has come by, the one that we need to be thankful first for is God. And you have to be thankful to have God in your life, be thankful for yourself, and understand yourself to be able to love your family and stand and support your husband is so important. And he's been just amazing. We thank all of our clients out there. We just think the world, you've become part of our family, and we can't thank you enough for that. And teaching just means so much to both of us. and to touch everyone. So for this, I just want to say thank you for being part of our family, and we're just very grateful this year, and just have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Well, I'm grateful to be here with such great people, and God put Cindy and Chuck into our life, I feel like, and I'm very grateful for friends. And first of all, though, I have to say that I'm thankful to God, and that I that He reached out and I said yes to Him to be part of His family. And then my family, my husband, I was just telling him this morning, I wouldn't want to be here without you. And as we're aging together, that we take care of each other. It's such a beautiful picture. We have freedom to worship. We don't. We can go to church. We can. Doesn't even have to be in a building. We can share the love of the Lord, the gospel, and we have freedom to worship. And then we have the freedom to bear arms here, which they were talking about, how this is not like any other country. I'm grateful that I was born here in America, and then especially in Alaska. This is my home, Fairbanks. So love you guys, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Got it. And so still got a couple minutes here. I just want to say, Cindy, I do have to caveat off of something that she said. So, yeah, kind of like a first sergeant right after the commander gives the weekend safety briefing, I need to do the same. So I'd like to caveat off of one thing that Cindy said, and one of the probably the greatest thing that we're appreciative of and grateful for is the students. You call them clients.
Yes.
But the students, mm-hmm. the people that we teach, the people that come to us trusting us, the C4 training group team, to basically train them to be able to be their own first responder. Because we understand, not only, and Matt, you kind of said this too, the world is an evil place, and it is. And just because you think that you're safe sometime, like, that is not going to keep you safe. Like I always say before, like, hope is not a self-defense plan. Well, I hope it doesn't happen. No. You need to prepare for that doesn't, you know, so that it doesn't mm-hmm. happen. So we're grateful for all of our students, the people that trust us with training their families, training the guys, training the men that are the protectors of their families.
Their daughters.
Their daughters, children. So that they have the ability to protect themselves, because we all know that you can pick up 911. Yeah, we talked about it before in other shows. Like, if you're relying on 911 and the troopers or somebody else to show up to save you in time, it's probably not going to happen. You need to be able to prepare for that yourself. So we're grateful for those of you who have taken the time to come to our classes, to learn how to prepare for your own defense, to prepare to protect your own family. And for that, we're incredibly grateful. So, but having said that, I really appreciate everybody staying tuned in with us today. I get it. You know, might have got a little too dramatic at the end, but that's us. We wear our hearts on our sleeves sometimes here. And I'm not going to be apologetic for that. Matt and I are men. I consider myself to be not only just a man, but I consider to be myself a man of God. And so I'm going to adhere to that, and I'm going to believe that. And I believe myself to be not only a protector of my family, but I'm also the prophet of my family. And it's my job to make sure that we celebrate God in our lives and in our house. So, and we celebrate our firearms. Because we love the Second Amendment, and God gave it to us because, like, we're awesome people. So with that, I'd just like to add, like, stay tuned for next week's and future weeks and future shows, because we're always going to be coming up with something crazy, funny, and new and educational.
And I'm thinking about something new for Christmas.
Yeah, well.
May go bang, bang.
Yeah, so stay armed, stay grateful, and finally, last but not least, God bless America.